few of the textbooks that are left that were ordered for our class in hermeneutics. This 25. And the passage read just a few minutes ago, you're well aware of the fact we've come to that point in the plan of God for Israel where the second patriarch and his wife, Rebekah, brought forth two sons. They are Jacob and Esau. We have gone through the details. We have considered the issues involved in terms of this birth, the significance of the birthright. But I'm going to do something by way of some very brief review. And then I want to bring this chapter together with what I think are some very crucial principles on some family life. And that is one of the great features of Genesis from, about chapter 24 on, is that you observe family living, both its failures and successes. Let's take a minute or two to review the case. We have Rebekah, who is barren. Isaac, as her protector, as her spiritual leader, he prays because she is barren. She conceives in her womb twins. These twins struggle together. She does not understand the significance of the pain. She thinks, perhaps, is this miscarriage? What is happening? She knew there was the promise. Would this be a temporary setback to the fulfillment of that promise? In verse 23, the Lord explains what is in her womb. Who is in her womb? Two nations, two peoples, one stronger than the other. The older, Esau, serving the younger, Jacob. It was God's sovereign purpose to pass along the promise to Abraham through the firstborn, Isaac, then through the one that God would sovereignly choose, namely, not the firstborn, Esau, but Jacob. Jacob was the one who would receive the birthright eventually. But Jacob takes things into his own hands. As the lads grew up, we find Jacob taking the initiative to procure the birthright. The birthright meant more than one thing. It meant that one was the head and protector of the family upon the death of the father. It meant that one came in for a double share of the inheritance. It meant, and most significantly of all in terms of Messiah, that it would be through his seed that eventually would come the Messiah. The promise would come and pass along through him. Jacob realizes the significance of the birthright. Do understand that. Jacob knew what he wanted. He was not out for just some piece of paper, or he was not out for just the promise of the Father. He understood the spiritual dimension to this. Esau did not. So lest you have the idea that Esau was a victim of a very shrewd brother who knew something that Esau didn't, you do not understand it. Esau knew exactly what was involved, just as well as Jacob. They knew from their grandfather as well as their father. The life of their grandfather overlaps with theirs for a few years. They knew the significance of the birthright and that primarily there was a spiritual significance to it. But obviously Esau has no regard for it. Jacob does. Now let's very quickly rehearse these two men, at least the profile on them, and then we can go right to those principles. Esau, one, chosen by God to serve Jacob. He would not receive the blessings of the firstborn. This was the sovereign choice of God. Two, Esau was physically superior to Jacob. He was, by the complexion of his skin, by his body, he was fitted for the outdoor life. At least he went in that direction. His physical traits were established at birth. Esau didn't have any say-so in that matter, and he's not to be held responsible for that. That was not a detriment. Esau, he was an outdoorsman. He enjoyed hunting. He was a rugged individualist. He was an independent spirit. But Esau was a man who was materialist. He was a materialist. He was profane. He didn't regard the birthright of any importance. He had very little appreciation for spiritual values. You can see that from the way the account is given. The translation brings it out vividly, doesn't it? Because I noticed a response on your part when I read the that particular translation. And you'll see it. He says, please, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there. I'm starved. I've got to have it. Was he really? Do you think he would have dropped over? Maybe his blood sugar was a little low and his stomach was growling. But he wanted some of that lentil stew. Had to have it. Here was a man who was more concerned for his physical appetites than he was for spiritual values. He was a profane man. He was a materialist. He was paternally preferred. Isaac preferred him, was partial toward him. I do get the impression that Isaac was a bit passive. Esau was not passive. It seems that here was the father who was drawn to a very aggressive son. Perhaps we are already told that the palate of Isaac dictated to some of his partiality, that he liked the fruits of Esau's labor. He liked that venison. Or we might put it in modern terms, here was a father who, he liked to go to ball games, and this son played ball. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Then there was Jacob. I don't think we'd understand Jacob as prissy. He sometimes is presented that way because he hung around the tent. I don't think that's the idea. He was more of an indoorsman maybe than Esau, but let's get a fair picture of him. He was chosen by God to be the ancestor of the Messiah, not Esau. He was to receive the rights of the firstborn. Physically, it says that he was a smooth man. He was not the hairy-chested man that Esau was. Socially, he was an indoorsman, the opposite of Esau. He was level-headed. I understand the word, the term for him, which says that he was peaceful, quiet, some translation places puts it. The Hebrew word here, tam, has an ethical meaning in other places, used in relation to Noah. Noah was, the King James is a perfect man, but one of integrity is the idea. I think that's the implication here. I think it's underscoring the fact that Jacob was a man who had integrity. He had some character that Esau did not have. He valued the birthright more than Esau. So Esau was not just hoodwinked out of the birthright. True, Jacob was taking matters into his own hands prematurely. He was not authorized by God, but yet he understood and appreciated Jacob appreciated the value of the birthright, whereas Esau didn't. And Jacob was maternally preferred. Rebekah was aggressive spiritually. She is drawn to a spiritually aggressive son. Could this happen? You have some children. One child is so eager for the word, and another or the others aren't. And you might be drawn to that one. We'll come back to that. Here we are. Esau and Jacob. Two different men. Question. And this will take us right to our first principle. How do children in the same family turn out so differently? Now, it's not hard to answer the question, how do children turn out so differently? I'm sure probably anyone among us could stand up tonight and give us some very good points and some insight on that. But how do children in the same family turn out so differently? I want to suggest four basic principles involved in explaining or answering that question. It takes us back to this case of Esau and Jacob. The first principle is that God's sovereignty determines or establishes different purposes. God's sovereignty establishes different purposes. God had a different purpose for Esau than he did Jacob. The direction, the destiny of their life was determined by divine calling. Esau was not to have been the recipient of the birthright. That was designed beforehand. How do we know? We know from Romans chapter 9 and verses 6 through 13. I think we need to look at that again. We were in it some months back in Romans, but let's rehearse it. It says concerning these two, and not only this, but there was Rebekah also when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, please notice that, God did not look down on the basis of pre-knowledge and make a selection of Jacob because he saw some qualities in Jacob that he didn't see in Esau. If that's your theory, you're not a grace person. And you're not operating on the principle God operated on. God looked down and made a decision before they had done good or bad. Now, did God see them doing good and bad? Sure. But they both did bad. It was not a selection based upon a decision either one made. In order that God's purpose according to his choice might stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. Just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. And then he goes on to make the continuing application, Pharaoh and his hardening of Pharaoh's heart. God chose Jacob to the position of firstborn. God rejected Esau as the firstborn. Now, we're not talking about salvation here, so rest your minds on that. God is not rejecting Esau from salvation. The issue is who will be firstborn in terms of position, rank, and the messianic promise to go through that one. I think there are some practical implications of that fact that God has a sovereignly established purpose for different children, a different purpose for different children. One is, I think we as parents ought to be very careful about trying to establish the purpose before the life of the child prematurely. Taking a, having in our own mind what that child should do and forcing it upon them without their entrance into the plans. It's easy for a parent to do this if, particularly, if that parent has in their mind that a certain vocation, a certain kind of service, a certain way of life is going to be the way to go. Maybe it's one that you prefer, you enjoy. And we look at the world through that window and we can only see our child doing that. Be careful. God may have an entirely different purpose from what you can think of. So I must be careful about pressing them into a mold that's not the mold for them. This takes keen insight from the parent, on the part of the parent, to recognize the child's bent, Proverbs 22:6, training up the child according to his bent. How he's, what kind of direction is he taking his interest? In what direction is God taking that child? Recognizing that, remaining sensitive to it, but all the time seeking to see character developed in the life of that child on the basis of their oneness in Christ. The second principle, and maybe I should rehearse that first again in this point, God has a plan for my child, and I want my child to know that. I may have a plan, but that may or may not be God's plan. I want my child to know that. Secondly, God's sovereignty establishes different personalities. God's sovereignty establishes different personalities. I do not believe that Jacob or Esau are that the basis of their, the direction of life that they went was on their personality. I mean by personality, Esau's preference for the outdoors and for the hunt, Jacob's preference for hanging around the tent. This matter of personality has always intrigued me. And I think it bears maybe a little bit of discussion, particularly when you try to, what parent hasn't, after the children have gone to bed, parents are sitting and you're talking about your children. They've lived long enough for you to see them begin to take a certain direction and begin to demonstrate certain characteristics. And of course, you like to try to see, are there any of these personality traits that one of you that have carried over into your child? And so you like to engage in that conversation. And it's not without meaning and purpose, or it shouldn't be. But what is personality? Personality is the sum total of all the traits of a person. It includes physical things, aspects, mental, emotional, all those factors. Now, there are, of course, different personality types. I don't know that there's any one system of measuring it. Some of you are familiar with the approaches. There is a book by Tim LaHaye. I personally would be very careful in adopting. I don't adopt that. I think it's too rigid. But I think there's an element of truth to it. But to take it and try to fit everybody into some category, which you don't think you can. You know the types. The sanguine type. The sanguine is the enjoying, optimistic, friendly, compassionate, but restless, weak-willed, egotistical, and emotionally unstable. The choleric, the strong-willed, practical leader, optimistic, but hot-tempered, cruel, impetuous, self-sufficient. The melancholy, sensitive, perfectionist, analytical, faithful friend, self-sacrificing, but self-centered, pessimistic, moody, revengeful. The phlegmatic, witty, dependable, practical, efficient, but slow, lazy, tease, stubborn, indecisive. I'm not suggesting that these can be consistently applied. I think you probably could find characteristics, good and bad, and maybe all of them in yourself. Now, certain characteristics probably dominate. Carl Jung divided personalities into extroverts and introverts. There is a book that's on the market now by Dr. Gregory Young, titled Your Personality and How to Live with It. He has observed 12 personality types. The adaptable personality, the person with the overwhelming urge to conform and who is an avid listener. The ambitious personality, the one who has the rating urge, as he says, always wanting to compare and rate himself with others. And the influencing personality, the urge to be for the ultimate, the conversationalist. Well, let me move on through this. The accomplishing personality, the patient personality, the determined personality, and perceptive personality, and so on. What all this represents is that there have always been attempts to categorize personalities, because why? There are obviously no two people are just alike. And we do see some things that characterize certain people, certain tendencies. Dr. Young says that we get our personality from one of our parents, not both, but one, and it's an inherited trait. I'm inclined to believe that our personality is for the most part determined by heredity in format. But in maturity through environment, it of course takes on a lot of things. It begins to get certain patterns, and there obviously, I think, would be a difference in personality if a child were taken from a home and put in another home at an early age. There are differences that otherwise would not have been. So I think how is the ratio of heredity and environment? I don't know. But I guess we can just summarize this by saying that God has a particular personality. It will, now, it's going to have its strengths. One child is going to be more aggressive than the other, more of a leader. One is going to be more emotional than another, and one is going to be more moody than another. I don't think the important thing is for you to try to find a label. But the important thing is to be alert enough as a parent to see what is the bent of your child. What has been given to this child through heredity? Because then you should move in and begin to get involved in what now brings us to human responsibility. That's the third principle. What determines the difference of children in the same home under the same roof? Human responsibility results in different circumstances. Human responsibility results in different circumstances. Do you think that Esau or Jacob's, Rebekah's preference for Jacob and Isaac's preference for Esau made any difference in the way they grew up? I think so. I think that Isaac had something that he could have given to Jacob that apparently didn't. And that Rebekah had something that she could have provided for Esau, and she didn't. The Spirit of God points out the fact that there was partiality. So the boys had a different experience. Even under the same roof, there are, of course, different circumstances. If you've moved, different schools, different times of life, different neighborhoods, and you have been different too, haven't you? You're different when you're 23 than you are when you're 35, in some very real ways. So, human responsibility results in different circumstances, and those changing circumstances have, in some sense, created a different environment for those children in your home. That's one reason why they're different. Now, that can be good and bad, or bad. And fourthly, human responsibility results in different decisions. Human responsibility results in different decisions. Now we come to the difference in character. What took Esau off in his direction as a man who was only interested in material things? And Jacob, who was a man who was interested in spiritual things. They made decisions. They decided. Esau is fully responsible for deciding to refuse the birthright and wanting some food instead of that. He was a man that condemned himself. He set his own character by his own decisions. He was responsible for his action, as well as Jacob. So they were not determined by their environment. But they determined what they would do by their own decisions. They affected their environment. And your children, therefore, you as a parent must be alert to the nature of their responsibility and instill within them the proper values. Seek to win them to Jesus Christ. Seek to train them in values, in qualities of character, at the earliest possible age. Notice their strengths and weaknesses. Well, I have no objection, for whatever it's worth, if you want to lay your hand on a book on personalities and try to understand your child better, as long as you don't impose something on them that's unreal or that's premature in judgment. But do recognize, and parents, if you haven't done this lately, don't do it in front of the children, but get together as husband and wife. Talk about your children and try to observe their strengths and their weaknesses and what their special needs are and how you can work as a team to meet those needs and so that in the process that you both can contribute to their growth. I want to come back to that in a minute when I speak of partiality. That's the first principle that I see in this passage. And that's the second is the matter of partiality. Here's the principle. That partiality in the treatment of children leads to hurtful consequences. Partiality in the treatment of children leads to hurtful consequences. I've already suggested why I think probably Isaac was drawn to Esau and Rebekah was drawn to Jacob. But it was not a good thing. Now, you may be naturally drawn to one child. I think it would probably be a little naive to think that you are not going to be drawn to certain things in one child and certain things in another. But listen, this is crucial. You as a parent and you as a team, husband and wife, you must together discuss this. And this is where you must discuss with the best kind of communication in truth. If you think that the other is being partial to one of the children, it's your responsibility to discuss that. Don't blow your stack. Start getting defensive. But how? In what ways? Because both of you have something to give to every child, and it will take special effort. You can develop blind spots and neglect needs of your child, of your children. How can you prevent partiality? I want to suggest four or five ways in which you can help to prevent partiality as a policy. Treating one child above or more, being more preferable to one than to the other. One, self-examination, as I've already said. Think it through. Are you? Do you spend more time with, in more conversation? Self-examination. Two, equal time. That might seem a bit legalistic, but might be the best way to start out. Equal time. As a rule, there are exceptions. Now, your children might want to get you to take this up. Well, you did this, you owe me this. It won't always work that way. And we've gotten that across to ours. That just because we do this particular thing doesn't mean that we've got to do exactly this. Because if we're seeking to be impartial and fair, it's going to come out all right. Because, you know, there was something back here a year ago or a month ago, and now that it'll work out. You trust us. They will see whether you're being impartial. They won't demand that you've got to have parity on exactly every act that's taken. Three, awareness of differences in children. Awareness of differences. And here is where you should be careful to, or where you would note what your strengths and weaknesses are, what your preferences are. Are different than you are. Four, acceptance of those differences. Acceptance of those differences. I know of a man who had two boys. One boy was athletic, the other boy was non-athletic. The father, very athletic. Boy number one, could care less. Boy number two, like sports. You see the potential problem? But this father was wise. He anticipated it. He took efforts to see that he entered into the interests of the one who was not interested in sports. He noted those interests, and he sought to identify with him in those interests. And it meant some self-sacrifice, too, going out of his way. And finally, five, better communication with your spouse. You need to talk this. Four eyes are better than two, particularly in the family. Better communication with your spouse. I'm going to stop with that principle. Let's close in prayer. Lord, may this we've done tonight be to our growth in Christ. Thank you for alerting us to our responsibility beyond the flock to the fields of the world. And Lord, may what we've considered here in Genesis correct perhaps some tendencies among our families. Help us to be careful, to invest our time wisely, the responsibility you've given to us for our children. In the name of Christ, amen.